And we come to our second reading. This morning we pick up in John chapter 20 at verse 10.
A reading from John chapter 20, beginning at verse 10. Then the disciples went back to their homes, but Mary stood outside the tomb crying. As she wept, she bent over to look into the tomb and saw two angels in white seated where Jesus' body had been, one at the head and the other at the foot. They asked her, "Woman, why are you crying?" "They have taken my Lord away," she said, "and I don't know where they have put him." At this she turned around and saw Jesus standing there, but she did not realise that it was Jesus. "Woman," he said, "why are you crying? Who is it you are looking for?" Thinking he was the gardener, she said, "Sir, if you have carried him away, tell me where you have put him, and I will get him." Jesus said to her, "Mary." She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic, "Rabboni," which means teacher. Jesus said, "Do not hold on to me, for I have not yet returned to the Father. Go instead to my brothers and tell them, I am returning to my Father and your Father, to my God and your God." Mary of Magdala went to the disciples with the news, "I have seen the Lord," and she told them that he had said these things to her.
Thank you to Daisy and Helen for this morning's readings. One of the biggest questions that seems to be coming up over and over again at the moment is, what will you be doing this Easter? It's a good question to ask. After all, we find ourselves in unique circumstances, don't we? The Easter holiday can't happen. The bank holiday weekend as such can't happen. The possibility to go to the National Trust Park for a wander around the daffodils can't happen. And sadly, families getting together over lunch can't happen. Bishop Stephen, who ends his tenure as the Bishop of Chelmsford today, had a variety of services and other events planned for these past few days as his way of saying goodbye to the diocese. Instead, his goodbye has been relatively low-key, and we do pray for him as he prepares to become the next Archbishop of York early next year. A few weeks ago, we ourselves had plans for the Easter period penciled into our diaries, and they were simply wiped clean. We had various plans for remembering and celebrating Jesus' death and resurrection ourselves here at Holy Trinity, and gradually they were moulded into something very, very different over these past few days. Plans come and go in a blink of an eye, and it is a reminder to us that we are not sovereign over the earth. God is, so it's obvious, it's true. And our current situation must act as a wake-up call to us all, that our plans must be made with reference to his will, and not simply thinking that we're doing whatever is a good idea at the time. But when we come to the Easter story, we see God's overarching plan for humankind open to us for all to see and to look at with bewildering astonishment. And it would actually be too easy to take the events for granted, or too easy to play lip service to seeing God's plan in action without it ever truly taking hold of us. We need to grasp hold of the truth of the events of that first Easter weekend, knowing that this is a plan that could not and would not be cancelled. I know that this was a plan that directly impacts on each one of us, whether we'll be able to enjoy the holiday aspect of the weekend or not, whether we're able to meet physically together or not. But what was the plan? Well, put simply, it was God's plan of redemption, of rescue for all humankind, and that reached its climax on the previous Friday, a couple of days before. what went on that early on that Sunday morning? Well, it'll come as no surprise that when I tell you that to understand Easter rightly, we have to look at Jesus. For God's plan centres around him. It centres around the cross. It centres around his resurrection. More specifically, it was about that once dead, now alive Jesus. And so all we're going to do for the rest of our time this morning is to think about the two passages that we heard read for us earlier from John chapter 20 and ask two critical questions. First, we simply ask the question, how can we be sure that Jesus rose from the dead? After all, this is the mystery at the heart of this whole thing, and actually quite key. And then secondly, what are the consequences of Jesus rising from the dead? So how can we be sure Jesus rose from the dead? Now at this moment, I'm going to stop for a moment, because the question assumes something rather important. It assumes that Jesus was dead in the first place. And in the previous chapter of John, we find two pieces of evidence, if you like. First, we read that because the Jews did not want the bodies left on the crosses during the Sabbath, they asked Pilate to have the legs broken and the bodies taken down. The soldiers therefore came and broke the legs of the first man who had been crucified with Jesus, and then those of the other. But when they came to Jesus and found that he was already dead, they did not break his legs. The Romans saw quite clearly that Jesus was dead, so they didn't need to break his legs in order to speed the process up. What makes this particularly acute is that they did break the legs of the two others who were crucified with Jesus, as they were still alive. Second thing, instead, one of the soldiers pierced Jesus' side with a spear, bringing a sudden flow of blood and water. Now, a Roman soldier aimed through the lungs and into the heart would have made once and for sure that he was dead. That's a truism. And a mixture of blood and water signifies the fact that the pericardial sac that surrounds the heart was ruptured and the liquid in it flowed out. So let's not mess around here. Jesus was well and truly dead late on that Friday afternoon. And as we move forward to that early on that Sunday morning, we find a number of clues that at the very least point to the fact that something strange was going on. A deeper magic before time dawned, as Aslan says in The Lion, the Witch and the Wardrobe. Mary Magdalene, Peter, and the other disciples that we know from other places is John, are all named as the first people to witness the empty tomb. Mary saw the huge stone blocking the entrance to the tomb had been moved, and she ran to Peter and John and said, "They have taken the Lord out of the tomb and we don't know where they've put him." What's Peter and John's reaction? Well, they run themselves, and we read the other disciple, John, outran Peter and reached the tomb first. He bent over and looked in at the strips of linen lying there, but did not go in, so he stuck his head in. As John peers in, he finds the tomb is empty. The strips of cloth Jesus had been wrapped in were empty. The grave clothes have been left behind. And then Simon Peter, who was behind him, arrived and went into the tomb. He saw the strips of linen lying there, as well as the burial cloth that had been wrapped around Jesus' head. The cloth was still lying in its place, separate from the linen. Had the body been stolen? Well, look, the tomb was incredibly tidy. And it doesn't strike me that grave robbers would have been particularly bothered about tidying up after themselves. A few years ago, many of you remember, the church was broken into and the office itself was trashed in search of money. Now, the guy didn't get a great deal of money out of it. We don't keep money in the office just for future reference. But he did make a reasonable amount of damage, and it made a right mess that needed to be sorted out. I think it's a fair assumption that something else was going on with that tomb. And the other thing is, John is spending a great deal of time describing in great detail what the linen was like. Why? Well, I think there's two reasons. First, John's saying, I know this to be true because I saw it for myself. John, the disciple, the writer, was the one who peered into the tomb. And second, that this level of detail is important because it tells us something about the wider story. Jesus is not there. But the final thing I should say is simply that if the grave had been robbed, then they wouldn't have left the brand new linen and presumably the spices left behind. They were too expensive simply to leave behind. No, John's telling us that the tomb was definitely empty and there's no other obvious human explanation. Well, the disciples go back. But Mary stays clearly upset at the turn of events, and who can blame her? She looks in the tomb and sees two angels. Woman, why are you crying? They ask. They have taken my Lord away, she said, and I don't know where they have put him. And she turns and meets a man she does not recognize, but turns out to be Jesus. Woman, why are you crying? Who is it you're looking for? Thinking he was the gardener, she said, Sir, if you've carried him away, tell me where you've put him, and I will get him. Having the gardener around was actually a logical thought. After all, what they were standing in was more than a simple garden. It was more likely to be an orchard or a plantation of some kind or other. And it's actually a very easy mistake to make, at least initially. Jesus said to her, Mary. She turned towards him and cried out in Aramaic, Rabboni, teacher. This exchange is simply wonderful, truly, truly wonderful. The risen Lord is meeting with one of his followers for the first time after his death. You can imagine the scene as Mary is so excited, so confused by the previous day's events, that she is on her knees, her arms flung around his ankles, holding on for dear life. It's a wonderful picture. It's no wonder Jesus continues with the words, do not hold on to me, and so on, as he's now in the period before he returns to his Father's side. It's trying not to be difficult or unpleasant to Mary, simply to say that the story, the plan, is not quite finished. Jesus has said all along that he would return to his Father, and that moment was fast approaching. Just an indication of what was to come a few weeks later. This sequence is very important, however. First of all, it shows that there is a very good reason why the tomb is empty. It's been made redundant. It's not necessary anymore. And secondly, it shows us that Jesus has bodily risen from the dead. He has a physical body. Now, I've heard it said that it was an imaginary thing, a figment of stressed and emotional people's imaginations. I've heard it said that it was a spiritual resurrection, that the disciples experienced Jesus' resurrection as if it was simply true in their hearts. But Jesus' grasping hold of Jesus shows that that's been nonsense, doesn't it? If we take the gospel seriously, as I think we should, most definitely, then we have to take seriously the physical aspects of the resurrection. You can't grasp hold of a spirit or a ghost. There's no substance to grasp hold of. You've got like this all the time, aren't you? Now, I'm more than willing to concede that Jesus' body has changed. Absolutely. Mary didn't recognise Jesus at first, did she? And even stranger things were to happen later that same evening, which we'll look at next week. But let's be quite clear, this is a bodily resurrection. So we need to come to our second question. What are the consequences of Jesus rising from the dead? And frankly, we could finish this morning having celebrated the joy and shared in the wonder of the resurrection. But if we hadn't believed it, If we hadn't taken it to our heart, then we would have been wasting our time. It's that important. So how did the two disciples and Mary respond? Well, a combination, I think, of astonishment and witness. Mary says to Jesus in verse 16, Rabboni, and then, witnesses to the somewhat sceptical disciples, I have seen the Lord. I think one of the problems that Peter, John and Mary had was that of expectation. When they went to the empty tomb that morning, they expected to see a corpse. They did not have a big enough view of who Jesus is. If they'd been looking for a victorious Lord, I think their response would have been very different. And it's not as if Jesus hadn't told them. Furthermore, the Old Testament points them in that direction. For example, in verse 16, Psalm 16, we read this. Therefore, my heart was glad and my tongue rejoices. My body also will rest secure because you will not abandon me to the realm of death, nor will you let your faithful one see decay. One writer says this about Jesus' resurrection. It has been shown that Jesus really has achieved all that he promised, and that the apostles really have seen heaven opened. Jesus is the true Israel, God's true Son, who has come from the Father. Therefore, all the blessings promised in the gospel are available to those who will listen and believe. The consequence of this is that we should allow Jesus to be Lord, to be King over every area of our lives. There shouldn't be a single area that's off limits to him. He's not simply a king to worship only on a Sunday morning, wherever that might be, just for a couple of hours, or if that, as things are going at the moment. He's king to worship over lunch, at the cinema, with our families, at work, at school, at the post office, at the hospital. Nothing is off limits. He is the king that we are to continue to worship through our present difficult circumstances, whatever they look like. Tim Chester says this. The resurrection means so many things. It is the confirmation of a finished sacrifice. It is a sign of our reconciliation to God. It is the promise of a new creation. But for Mary, the resurrection is personal. And so it is with us too. Our Saviour lives. He is present with us by his Spirit, and one day we will see him face to face. And he'll be as real to us then as he was to Mary that morning. God has a plan. It's a plan that means we can share in joy beyond limit, a hope without restraint, love beyond imagination. It's a plan that means that we can know the truth and enjoy the benefits of that truth. It's a plan that means that we can pass from death to life, from sin to forgiveness, from brokenness to wholeness. In short, it's a plan that means living life like we've never known it before. So on a day when so many plans have been adversely affected, let's live in the light of God's plan, a plan that cannot fail, his ultimate good plan of rescue and new life. Amen.